Well, lurking at the most remote extreme area of our solar system, if scientists are correct in their calculations, is an extraordinary discovery that could utterly transform our understanding of the sky above our heads. The possible existence of a new giant planet, Planet Nine as it's been called, has gripped the world of astronomy. But it's not just for those observations. What about horoscopes and astrology, if indeed it is real? It could change that too. So many people over the years that I know have, that I've interviewed, have talked about a Planet X. Nancy Leader, Mark Hazelwood, Zachariah Sitchin, and so many more. Up next, Jason Martell joins us. We'll get his take on all of this next on Coast to Coast AM. Jason Martell has been one of the leading researchers and lecturers specializing in ancient advanced technologies. He has worked on scientific recreations of ancient technology based upon data obtained from Sumerian cuneiforms. Those are the same records, cylinders that Zachariah Sitchin has looked at, seals from 3000 BC. He's also planning several groundbreaking international research projects as well. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Jason, good to have you with us. Well, folks, I think we have a phone problem somewhere. Somewhere, someplace.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me on your show.
Good to have you. Where were you?
I am.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay.
Okay. We're having some problems getting you on the air, but you're there with us now.
Sorry to hear that, George. Well, technology, sometimes I call my PC personal confuser.
Let's switch to the phone. Let's have Tom call you back, okay?
Yep, all right.
Tom, take care of it. Get that done. Just way too many little issues there. We do not want internet problems. Apparently, William Craig Reed was on an internet phone as well, and there might be a national internet issue going on somewhere. Whoa, I wonder if we're under attack or something like that. So get him on the phone, Tom, and let's get him on. There he is. Are you back?
I'm here.
Yeah, let's do this. It'll be much, much safer.
Very odd, though, that as soon, like literally, like 30 seconds before going on the air, my internet.
Is that that's what happened? It happened to my other guest too. Something's going on with the internet.
Feeling the love. It's okay.
All right. So, anyways, we're back. Well, what's your take on these two scientists that believe there's a extra planet out there in the solar system and a big one?
Yeah, well, I mean, here we go again, George, right? I mean, you know, this is a kind of the cat chasing the tail or the dog chasing the tail routine. We've been doing this for well over a decade. So, you know, this Caltech professor, Mike Brown, and his assistant, who's more of the theorist doing the mathematical calculations, they seem to be pretty much right on point with a scenario that we've been playing out for well over a decade and looking for something, some type of massive object. And it seems like this might be the candidate.
Well, they've used their calculations, and they're pretty well convinced that that's definitely a big planet out there. This is what's amazing. People like you, Nancy Leader, Mark Hazelwood, Marshall Masters, Zachariah Sitchin, these people have all talked about an extra planet in the solar system way before we had scientific evidence, way before.
Yeah, but George, I have to stop you there and kind of push back a little bit on the grouping of the names you just put forth there. Zachariah Sitchin stands apart from people like Nancy Leader or Mark Hazelwood or anyone else. You know, these people are all kind of come and gone or are little blips in the night, where Zachariah Sitchin put forth 50 years, it's 50, 50 years of research.
Oh, I agree.
Around these topics.
I agree.
So,
and yeah. Did they pick up on his work and jump on? I'm just saying that there were a small handful of people who talked about this way before science got involved.
Oh, of course. And I think even today you'd agree that it's still pretty prolific on the internet. People hear Planet X, Nibiru, and it is an interesting topic. And, you know, I just thought it'd be fun tonight to not only give your audience some history around some of the research related to Zachariah Sitchin, but also the science tracking of Planet X But there's a lot of that ancient foundation that, again, you know, this planet, George, is pretty much in the ballpark for the ancient Nibiru. Now, the actual color spectrum of how it looks to the physical eye, its actual orbit, there are some differences, but I think what we're seeing here is a spark of new information around the idea that a planet like a Nibiru, with beings that live on this planet and visited us in the past, could be possible. And more specifically, that, you know, we can start to talk about in tonight's discussion how a planet could have such an elongated orbit. What would cause it to loop back around towards us, and what could be looming out there? So there's a lot of new science that starts to just bring up this same old story around the ancient planet X, Nibiru.
Well, Sitchin said that this elliptical orbit for this one is 3,600 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's way out there. This one, I think they have said it goes around the sun every 10,000 years, but they could be off, right?
Exactly, George. And we're not even saying that, you know, that this is it. Like, this is Nibiru. We have no idea. And so what's really interesting, George, just to kind of back it up a little bit before Mike Brown's research and others. And again, Mike Brown, you know, he's very prominent because he's kind of the one that demoted Pluto. And in all fairness, I don't ever, at least in my lifetime, I'm not going to consider Pluto not a planet, right? I mean, to me, it's
a planet.
Yeah, and all the ancient cultures, even specifically the one we're going to kind of dive into tonight, Sumerian culture, they recognized it as a planet. So I'm going to kind of stick with the evidence that precedes, you know, it came before our current understandings of flipping the planet names around. So what's really interesting, though, George, is to look into the past and see the track record of data that we have, which kind of did start around the time of Zachariah Sitchin writing his book called The 12th Planet in 1976. And what we have is Zachariah Sitchin not only making connections to this ancient Sumerian culture, it's very specific in saying that their gods, the Anunnaki, came here and they visited us from another planet within our solar system that they called Nibiru. Now, it sounds like a science fiction story, you know, in a high-level description, but as we delve further into this topic, we see that the Sumerian culture has left us, and science and, you know, modern academics confirm this, over 100 of the firsts needed for a modern civilization. And a big part of their knowledge was astronomy. So they tracked the movements of the heavens, the stars, certain constellations, you know, over hundreds of years, sometimes thousands of years. So it's really a stacked up of evidence that, you know, they have a lot of academic information around astronomical observations in many other cultures. But where they cross the line is that they say, well, wait a minute, we are tracking one other planet as well. But this is a special planet because it's where the gods come from, the gods that we interact with that we call Anunnaki, which simply means those who from heaven come to Earth. So Zachariah Sitchin, you know, looking into all these ancient texts, then started to branch out from this information and try and confirm this data. And in doing so, he first went to the Naval Observatory in Washington in the early 80s and met with someone named Dr. Robert Harrington. And he was the lead astronomer at the time for the Naval Observatory. And again, this is early 80s. He had been plotting a planetary course to explain all the orbital anomalies in our solar system, why Uranus is tilted on its side. Could it be that Neptune and Pluto were dislodged moons of Saturn at one time? All the weird things that are going on our solar system, he could explain by interjecting one large planet that swept through and caused all these perturbations, if you will, is the term that he used. And essentially, that's the same model that Mike Brown is kind of looking at today with his assistant, is they're using math to determine that, wow, there is something that's pulling on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, George, this has been going on for a very long time. Even when we sent the first probes like Voyager 1 and Galileo, their orbits became retarded as if something was pulling at them. but we still have not been able to find what that source of the pull is.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind, Jason, that there's something out there, and there may be more than just this one out there. I'm not sure that this one is the planet X, but something's out there.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet, too. You know, when they first found, like, Xena or Sedna, a Quoar, right? We found all these little, somewhere in the realm of 800 to 1,000 kilometers in diameter planetoids, or dwarf planets.
To me, they're asteroids.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, it's not even a planet. So Pluto being demoted was not, you know, something I agree with, but I understand the logic behind it. And so even since the early 80s when, you know, Dr. Harrington was meeting with Zachariah Sitchin, Zachariah Sitchin says, you know, look, I've been looking into these Sumerian cultures, and they plot this orbit that's 3,600 years, very elongated, going into the southern ecliptic plane. And Dr. Harrington says, my God, well, that's very close to the model that I'm plotting. And it, you know, shows a 3D model of essentially what we have today with Mike Brown's model, very similar and kind of like a T-shaped orbit where everything on our planets are on a certain ecliptic plane. But then a planet X, or this rogue planet, has a very elongated and far off the ecliptic plane orbit, almost making it like a T, the upper part of the and lower part of the T, where all the other planets are in the smaller part of the cross. So it's very interesting that that model of this very elongated planet that just is a rogue planet and it has a very elongated orbit, that's something that we've been looking at for well over a decade.
Yep.
And, you know, Zachariah Sitchin and Dr. Harrington both compared their research on camera, both agreed that it would be coming out of the southern ecliptic plane. And it's just a very interesting track record of information that we've seen over the at least the last decade, that every couple of years something else resurfaces, Planet X, possibly found. But these are all mathematical calculations at this point. More than likely, George, we've already photographed Planet X, or even Nibiru, more specifically, probably many, many times. The problem is identifying it. We use these, you know, telescopes and take large shots of the sky, and they store them as plates, is what they're called.
Right.
And so these digital plates have thousands of stars and all kinds of things on them that you have to analyze certain plates and do the mathematical analysis.
And if you see one star or something out of kilter, they figure there it is, right?
Exactly. So there's a lot of candidates on all of the data that they've been gathering over the years for a Planet X. But the problem is being able to distinguish what the orbit of some of these stars are. And this planet that they've been able to identify seems to have an orbit, which makes it a part of our own solar system. And who knows how many more planets are out there. The kicker of this story and where we're going with this is, you know, if there is a Planet X, some ancient Planet X or a Nibiru that's talked about by the Sumerians, then we could possibly have actual ancestors that live on this planet.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Now, what kind of a heat source do you think a planet that is out that far has, even if it might have inhabitants? How does it stay warm?
Well, there's always been theories around Planet X as far as how it could sustain heat just orbiting our one sun. The idea that, you know, it goes so far into deep space and there's no other heat source out there, so that it must have certain properties which would allow it to retain heat. And that's pretty much still true. Nibiru, as described by the ancients, you know, the Sumerian culture, they wrote down that it was a very luminous planet, bright red, and that one of these gods actually explained and sat down with a priest and gave a wealth of information as to why they even came here in the first place, which was to mine gold. And the reason why they needed gold was in their own rise to a technological civilization, they damaged the atmosphere of Nibiru. And so they found that they could take fine particulates of gold and shoot it into the atmosphere and create a synthetic patch over these holes and keep the heat more insulated. So more than likely, Nibiru probably is emanating its own light somehow, like natural luminescence, and also has the ability to expel heat and trap it based on its atmosphere. Now, another variable that we haven't really considered up till now is that more than likely, or at least considered it in more weight, is the idea that we are a binary solar system.
Which means two stars in the system.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, that we have two suns. Not just one, but two. So a binary solar system would point to the idea that Nibiru, a planet X, maybe not even just one planet, but several, are caught in a much larger orbit, not only around just our one sun that's active, but our second sun that has now become what we would call a brown dwarf or a dark star.
So
the idea that a brown dwarf or a dark star is even kind of a new concept, just till about 10 years or so ago, they started to make new classifications of gas giant planets that they call brown dwarfs, red dwarfs, even yellow dwarf stars. But some of these just are, as a brown dwarf, are seriously dense, compacted matter that don't really have a large heat source, but still have a very large amount of gravity. So that question comes up a lot, George, but we're going to kind of spider off into that topic, which is, you know, how does Nibiru sustain its orbit going into the depths of space? Well, it's probably because it's orbiting a second sun. Now, the second sun angle of Nibiru is a huge part of this story, George. It actually might even tilt the topic away from a planet into looking for something else. I'll touch on this slightly as one part of the idea. You're familiar with Walter Cruttenden, who's a colleague of mine.
Another great job. That's right.
Very, very intelligent man, and he runs something called the Binary Research Institute. And, you know, they've been calculating a model looking for what could be this other pole, this anomaly. And instead of it being a planet, could it be an actual star system, possibly Sirius A and B? Not actually just one sun, but a pair of suns, twin suns that we're possibly in orbit with. And that's something that I'd probably have Walter expand on further.
Sure.
But point is there's a lot of new data, science coming out to expand on the idea of us having a binary solar system, but then computing the model behind not only how it's affected us and other ancient cultures in this binary orbit, because there seems to be a connection with the rise and fall of civilizations, but this idea that there's a Nibiru also trapped in some kind of an orbit, not only around one sun, but two. So whether or not this great anomaly of is it a missing planet or is there some other thing out there that we haven't identified? What's really interesting about this, George, is that it's continuing the idea that everything the Sumerians put forth around the idea of a planet X seems to still be holding its weight.
Well, it is holding its weight. There's no doubt about that. And speaking of weight, Jason, when we come back, let's talk about whether you think this planet could be inhabited or not. Which again echoes the incredible work of Zechariah Sitchin. And for folks who are brand new to the program, who aren't familiar with Sitchin, we'll talk about his work. He's no longer with us, passed away at the age of 90, but what an incredible mind. Back in a moment with Jason Martell on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. We will take your phone calls next hour with Jason Martell. Jason, do you believe then this object that they think they have found could be indeed Nibiru?
You know, probably not. Nibiru, as described by the ancient Sumerian Epic of Creation, which Zechariah Sitchin translated, is around 4 to 8 times the size of Earth. And it would take it in an orbit, as you mentioned, around 3,600 years. And that number 3,600 seems to be a very well-calculated number based on even breaking down 360 degrees and just adding another zero, right? It's a very symmetrical number that follows along the mathematical lineage of Sumerian culture. But it is an interesting candidate that does speak to, again, a whole slew of information that's come out over the last couple of decades. You know, there's been other theories too, George, right, that they slant on this. One came out recently called the Orpheus theory, and it explains that a large rogue planet enters our solar system in the past and smacks our primitive Earth, and in such a way that the debris coalesce to form our moon.
That's right. And right? That's probably a pretty palatable theory, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, there's been a couple others. About 10 years ago, a gentleman named Dr. Richard Mueller out of Berkeley came up with a theory called the Nemesis theory. You probably remember that one, but it's essentially, he calculated that there was another large planet that essentially got ejected from the Oort cloud, which is a huge asteroid belt well beyond Pluto. And his theory was that periodically this planet's orbit through the Oort cloud would eject other debris like comets and asteroids, and that was what was subjecting us at a much longer orbit over millions of years, you know, would cause it to impact Earth. And he theorized that's probably what caused the extinction of the dinosaurs, that there was some large rogue planet on its orbit periodically dislodging debris from the Oort cloud and sending it hurtling towards us. And in theory, too, there is some logic to that, because a lot of our planets, our moon, even us, we've just been bombarded, right, by comets and debris over the last, you know, who knows, millions of years.
Jason, for people who aren't familiar with the work of Zechariah Sitchin, he has come under fire by some people. He's not around to defend himself. You are. What would you say to those critics?
You know, George, I had a great deal of respect for Zechariah Sitchin, and it does hurt my feelings that I respect him. And over the years since his passing, even some of my colleagues have chosen to bash his research or say that their theory is more prominent than his, or that they have more understanding of the Anunnaki or Nibiru. And I keep quiet. And, there was another gentleman that should have been carrying this torch, George. He should have been the advocate of Zechariah Sitchin. His name was Eric Polterick. Unfortunately, he lost his life.
Ugh.
Eric was the one that should have been carrying the torch, and I wanted to support him to do that because, you know, while I followed Zechariah Sitchin very closely, I sit in both camps, Zechariah Sitchin and Eric von Daniken. Eric Polterek was very much a linguist like Zechariah Sitchin, could read ancient texts. He had fluent understanding of Hebrew. So Zechariah Sitchin, right, was one of these few people, I mean, at his time of his death, it was only about 250 people in the world that could actually directly translate Sumerian cuneiform script. So why Sitchin became so famous, George, is, you know, he became very interested in some of these cuneiform texts. One tale in particular called the Epic of Creation. And this is really what he formed his basis of research around and his first book, The 12th Planet, and stems all of the information for the basis of the Nibiru. In the Bible, we have 7 days of creation. Well, we found out that most of the Sumerian stone tablets are the original biblical versions of these stories. And the Sumerian Epic of Creation has 7 tablets of creation, not 7 days of creation. And there's a much more elongated tale in this Epic of Creation, spawns, I believe, 12, possibly 13 tablets. But there are literally 7 tablets of creation, not 7 days of creation. There's a much more elongated story rather than what we have in Genesis, where the Sumerian version explains, and this is where Zechariah Sitchin took some liberties in his translations that some of the mainstream scholars just have a problem with seeing these connections, even though the ancient astronaut theory and shows like ancient aliens expand on these visual connections beyond just the text, which I want to make clear that's a point we'll come back to. But the texts themselves, Zechariah Sitchin was very clear in interpreting that the Epic of Creation is telling us a story about how our solar system first came into formation. And then it gets into the details of Earth and us, but very specifically it says that before the planets had become a solid mass, an intruder planet shows up. And on one of the successive orbits where this planet eventually got sucked into our orbit around our sun, where it's the gravitational effects of Uranus and Neptune and eventually even Jupiter pulled this ancient planet X in. And on one of the orbits, one of the moons, the main moon, which the ancients called Kingu, this main moon of Nibiru or Planet X, actually struck our primitive Earth. It literally physically smacked us and caused this huge collision, which smacked us so hard that our Earth was put into a new orbit, and the debris, all the chunks and small debris from that collision, spewed out to what we have today as the asteroid belt.
Yep.
Even the Bible still refers to that as the hammered out bracelet. So in the Sumerian version, it goes on to explain where Nibiru, then after this collision has a continued orbit of around 3,600 years, only passing through our inner part of the solar system every 3,600 years or so. And what's really interesting about that information, George, is that if we look at the area between Mars and Jupiter, you know, we have the asteroid belt, and there appears to be enough room between Mars and Jupiter for another planet to have once been orbiting.
There should have been one there.
Yeah. There are literally holes in certain parts of the asteroid belt where it looks like a large body has passed through it. And I've always kind of joked around as a side note that, you know, we're talking about, at least from the Sumerian perspective, the 12th planet, as Zechariah Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, and the 12th planet passing between Mars and Jupiter. So that possibly Mars, Jupiter, 12th planet, is that MJ-12? I don't know. I just thought that was always an interesting little ufology connection. Probably nothing.
Can't planetary scientists, though, Jason, take this 3,600-year orbit and pinpoint where this planet might be?
They can, but again, only relatively speaking. When we take a 3D plate of the sky, a lot of times they capture all types of different objects that are extrasolar planets or even rogue stars and such. But being able to calculate the orbit of all of these different objects is really like a, you know, finding a needle in a haystack. So that's why, you know, Dr. Brown, or, you know, Mike Brown's research, this professor at Caltech, he, you know, being able to find an orbit that actually does support this idea that, right, there's this large gravity well, there's something pulling on the planets and even the probes. So this is a planet that meets those calculations. It fits the model for explaining possibly why we have a lot of these orbital anomalies in our solar system.
Well, it's incredible that they're finding these when we talked about it way before there were actual discoveries.
Well, you know, George, you talk about way before. I mean, one of the tablets that Zechariah Sitchin translates, it's a circular tablet, which that in itself was really odd because they didn't even think at the time of the Sumerians that man had understanding of the wheel, which is sad. Anyways, here they have a circular tablet, and on this circular tablet, there's an actual description where it describes the path the Anunnaki take coming from outside our solar system, making course corrections around the outer planets, counting certain planets, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, until they reach the 7th planet, Earth. Now, some people might think we're the 3rd planet from the sun, but if you're coming from outside the solar system in, we're actually the 7th planet. And so there's actual models of the ancient Sumerians having this knowledge of how these Anunnaki actually traveled from Nibiru to Earth. And on the side of this description on this tablet, there are little translated words that say things like rocket, pile up, mountain, high. So it's a very interesting text that seems to describe a let's call it a space chart or a course correction used by the Anunnaki in their navigational course towards Earth.
You're going to be at the Alien Snowfest with me, by the way, the first weekend of February.
Yes, that's going to be quite an event. I'm going to be giving a new lecture, too, that we're not going to kind of touch on too much tonight, but I'm looking into the Ark of the Covenant and how it was being used as a great battery to power the pyramid, and that's probably why during the Exodus they came after either Moses or Akhenaten. We can talk about that in the lecture, but I'm going to be reviewing some new research around the Ark of the Covenant, and I do look forward to this because it's going to be a new event. Hopefully that will stay on the radar in Southern California and allow more people that are interested in these topics another venue to come meet us firsthand and explore these with us.
Jason, back in 1960, NASA paid the Brookings Institute $50,000, which would be $400,000 today, to research the possibility of what would happen if alien life were discovered. How would we react? Why did they do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, that Brookings report is something that those are principles and procedures that are still being upheld today that are way outdated. Originally, NASA contracted the Brookings Institute to analyze if they ever found extraterrestrials or even, you know, microbial bacteria, how should we handle this, not only from a procedural standpoint, but also from a society standpoint. And a lot of the findings in the Brookings report basically said that they wouldn't want to quarantine not only the astronauts if they became infected or exposed, but even the knowledge of the idea that we're not alone is something that could have dramatic effects on our culture. And they chose to say that, well, we'd probably have to quarantine that information too, as well, you know, until there was a proper time to release it. NASA has had a great policy of not really kind of coming outright with all of the data that they have, kind of being very withholding of research until they can come up with a hypothesis that's very well-rounded. So their track record isn't really that great of being the most forthcoming of revealing information. But there is something that we see happening now where there's a lot of this SpaceX and other companies that are going to continue to build equipment and send those into, you know, into space beyond the control of things like the Department of Defense and National Security Agency at some point. That's really the barrier now, George, though, is a lot of these things that are happening in space, even things like trying to look for a planet like Nibiru. We don't have access to some of the higher realms of technology or even space telescopes that I'm sure NASA and Department of Defense and some of these agencies have control over.
One of the things that has fascinated me, too, with all this work, Jason, has been the ancient depictions of rocket ships. We talk a lot about that, both of us in Ancient Aliens. But, my God, we were either very highly technologically advanced or we had a lot of visitors.
Well, a lot of these depictions that we have, at least from the Sumerian culture, depict what we would look at as an ancient rocket ship. They actually had a term called a shem, which they explained that these Anunnaki would be orbiting in craft, larger craft, around the Earth, and then would use a shem to then come as a landing pod down to Earth. And this looks very similar to the idea of what we would do now, meaning we have landers and orbiters and things that would depart from, let's say, our shuttle or, you know, space station and then go down to the planet's surface. So there seems to be, not only in the Sumerian culture, but others, even Hindu and some of these things that we would call a stupa. We see Buddha sitting in a stupa. It looks essentially like some type of a conveyance of flight, like he could literally fly the stupa. So a lot of these depictions that we have from the Sumerian culture do show evidence of rocket flight. A lot of people would ask, too, like, well, if they're so advanced, Anunnaki are coming from another planet, why are they using rockets? I don't know, George, but there's enough evidence to substantiate that. There's a famous king called Gilgamesh, and in one of his stories, again, recorded in Sumerian cuneiform, Gilgamesh visits Baalbek in Lebanon, but at a time before it was Lebanon, it was just Baalbek. And there weren't cities stacked on these great platforms. It was just a big landing platform. Those megalithic stones at one point at Baalbek were just a huge platform. And literally, Gilgamesh explains that he, here at Baalbek, witnessed the gods coming down from the heavens and ascending into the heavens as well, using some type of a craft that he described as having great thunderous sounds, fire and smoke. Sounds pretty much like a rocket launch.
It sure does. It sure does. And the pictures are incredible. Abydos.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, Abydos, yes.
That's an amazing picture all by itself, isn't it?
You know, a lot of people would question the Abydos hieroglyphics to say these are hieroglyphics that were carved over older ones, and so that's why we see the shape. But I agree with you, George. Abydos, in my book, is a great example, because I can put it into a category of a much larger grouping where other cultures have these types of artifacts. And as we're touching on with the Sumerians and the rocket ships, I mean, they're definitely one of the first cultures that seems to describe the use of the conveyance of flight. One of their seals actually shows a scene where it's the gods bringing a farmer up to one of the kings and they're granting him the plow. It's like the age of modern agriculture.
Yeah.
But as a backdrop, it's VA-243. Anyone can just Google it, VA-243. But that seal, as a backdrop, shows a complete model of our solar system with all the planets that we know of, and the sun is in the center. Now, just below that, I'm going to come back to that piece, but just below that, there appears to be, George, a rocket sitting on a launch pad.
Jeez.
With those two arms holding it up so that, you know, like when the rocket would launch, one of the arms kind of falls away. That's literally what you see in the seal right below the solar system. They put a little rocket on a launch pad. Hello? Now, what's really interesting about this seal is that the seal shows the sun in the center and all the planets around it. And this is from around, let's say, 2500 BC, maybe 3000 BC, the latest. And so what's interesting is that at that time, 3000 BC, the Sumerians are clearly depicting that they knew we orbited the sun. But what happens is we descend from 3000 BC and go down further until we reach the Dark Ages, and it's kind of like Game of Thrones on HBO, and everything's physical and not very much spiritual. We forget all this knowledge, and then it's not until the time where we come out of the Dark Ages, and it's the Renaissance, and we have Galileo and Copernicus, and then they start to rediscover what it seems the Sumerians and ancient Egyptians had very, you know, standard knowledge of. We forget this knowledge and go into the Dark Ages, and we're now just starting to relearn a lot of these topics. That what's interesting to us is we look at the past and see the ancient Sumerians and the Egyptians having all this high knowledge, and we don't understand why in the past there was higher cultures, and now we're just rediscovering it.
Let's take some calls when we come back, Jason, and chat more.